passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED lights, and more, whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the long and winding railroad. My name is W.H. Park, and this is, of course, the show here at Post Wrestling that looks at I'm going to say it because of our guest today, the must-see matches of All Japan Pro Wrestling in the 90s. And the reason I use that phrase is because my guest today is the co-host of a really great podcast that I think a lot of people who like this particular show should check out. It's called Must-See Matches, and one of the co-hosts of that has been a guest on this show and has contributed to Post Wrestling. No stranger to people who are fans of Post Wrestling, that's Mark Buckledy. But the other person who does the show with Mark is Kieran LaFord, and he's joining us today. Hello, Kieran. How are you?
I am fantastic. It's a lovely, gloomy day in London, but I've closed my curtains so I can't see it, and I've come to talk wrestling with you.
Oh, thank you so much. So as of this day recording this, I am about like two and a half hours away from having dinner with Mike Murray and my good friend and John Pollock, and because we are going to go see Game Changer Wrestling here in Toronto, and I will be doing a show with John Pollock, post for a show later on that people might be released before this show's release, actually, the way you know podcasting works. But I'll be giving my live thoughts about that show with John on that particular episode of Post Perez. So stay tuned for that, or go look for it, since it's probably going to be released before this show. Anyways, Kieran, tell us about what is Must See Matches? What is the purpose of this particular podcast venture you do with Mark?
So the Must See Matches project, it was a brainchild of Mark. He set up a fresh Twitter account, and he basically said, wrestling fans, send me a list of up to 25 matches that you think other fans should see. And there was a cutoff date of March 31st, 2022. At the time, I wasn't working, so I came in to help tabulate all this stuff and build the spreadsheet, track down the matches or at least records of them, and in some cases, making sure they actually happened. Like, I spent several hours trying to work out if Tommy Rich really was in Puerto Rico on a particular day in 1987. Mark was then just going to put the data out and maybe write some articles, and I went, well, hang on, you've done all of this work. Podcasting is the thing at the moment. If we don't make a show about this, someone else is going to take all of this data and do it themselves. So we decided we'd do a podcast. And the idea is, every week we run down a match from the top. It was going to be the top 100, but the way the maths worked out, it's actually the top 104 over 1,000 unique nominated matches that we got. So every week we talk about one of these matches, and we're going from of that 104, the ones with the least nominations up to the one that got the most nominations. The match that got the most nominations, it's no secret because Mark's put the list out. It's Bret Hart versus Steve Austin from WrestleMania 13. And that got 32% of nominations. So one third of the people who responded nominated that match.
Is here.
Yeah. We talk about a match each week, usually with a guest on. It's usually someone who nominated the match so they can talk about why they think it's must-see, or like an expert in a particular field. And we break down the match, talk about the context, we talk about what makes it must-see, or sometimes even if it is still must-see, which in some cases, you know, some wrestling ages better than others, the same way some music and some movies age better than others. And that's it. It's like it's an incredibly diverse list with WrestleMania main events to 80s Joshi to Ring of Honor to Futen Bachi Bachi. It's exploding death matches in Japan. And we've had WHs come on, podcasters like Alan Forel and Dylan Fox, Strigger from Cage Match, WXWCO Felix Kohlenberg has come on, Joshi experts like Alex from Berubara Tag Boom, Sarah Parkin, and some current wrestlers, including Daniel Carbe came and talked to us. It's a fun time. Available every week, wherever you get your podcasts. I've got a friend who calls that my ex-bucket, and I usually do it at the end of a show.
Okay. I just want to say, like, we might have had some cutting out of I think we're having some a little bit of problems here. But just like Karen said, the basic concept is they have this list of historical matches throughout the history of wrestling. Him and Mark bring it on every week and talk about it in depth. And I've been a guest on it, and a lot of people who've been on this show have been on Must See
Matches. I was looking at
I always look forward.
We have a heck of a crossover when it comes to guests.
Yes, I think it helps that people like to do retro shows. I feel. You know, they don't necessarily want to talk about wrestling today. They want to talk about, the wrestling I came up with or the wrestling I grew up with and the wrestling is actually better than stuff today.
One of the reasons I really enjoy it is I'm discovering new stuff. So I had not seen any of like the 80s Joshi stuff we're talking about and watching. Like, I'd never seen the famous Dump and Chickasaw Nagayo hair match. And like that made the list, and I got to watch that. And that's just like an incredible, that's basically a self-contained half hour television program. That's just an incredible watch from start to finish. And so that's what I really enjoy about not just reliving my youth and getting to talk about the stuff. Cause Mark and I submitted lists as well. It's not just getting to talk about the stuff I know I like, but also discovering new stuff.
I think for me, that's also like kind of as a listener of that podcast that I like is like, okay, they're going to talk about this. I should, they have a link. You guys have a link for where to find the match. I'm going
to
watch it.
Like, if it's publicly available on YouTube, we try to put a link up as well. Yeah.
And then, I'll listen to, like, I'll watch it and then I'll try to listen to you and your guests talk about, you know, whatever the match is. I think for me, like, one of my blind spots is actually 90s Joshi and 80s Joshi as well. But like, but 90s is more where I would like to kind of explore more of as a priority, you know, versus like the decade earlier. But I think you guys are doing a great job. I think it's nice eclectic list. That's what I like about it. It's not just Japanese. It's not just American. It's not just Mexico. It's everywhere. You maybe Puerto Rico. You said you're researching.
Yes, the Puerto Rico stuff got nominated, but I don't think any of it made the top 104 that we're going to be talking about. Unfortunately.
Okay. Did Tommy Rich wrestle in Puerto Rico in that particular
day? Saying yes, because I can't find that he didn't. Like, he definitely did around that time, but I don't know if he did on the specific date that was mentioned. Because like, a lot of people have nominated stuff with like the TV air date on it rather than the taping date, which is confusing for some stuff. So that was like part of my job was I basically played internet detective. I called myself Headlock Holmes, and I went around the internet trying to find out, you know, if this stuff happened, when it happened, where it happened, all that kind of thing, making sure they were all real.
I like that. I'm also like that with like, you know, finding footage. Like also, where should I look? And then I'll ask different people like, where do I find this? I'll go to this site. This site has it and what have you. But yes. So today we're going to talk about a match from 1999 that you picked. What is the match we'll be talking about, Kieran?
So I actually found out today it's the Champion Carnival Final in 1999. I didn't know this when I picked it. it is Vader versus Kenta Kobashi from is April 15th or 16th? 16th, right?
April 16th, 1999. It is the finals of that year's Champion Carnival tournament, and it kind of kind of like is a capping off of a really good year for Vader. You know, the thing we have to keep in mind, like, you know, he up until late 1998, he had been in the WWF for about 2 years. He had a very, I would say as a fan, a very disappointing run in that company.
Oh, completely. So I've been a Vader fan since I first saw him on 1992 WCW. Like, that was the wrestling of my youth. Like, that was what was on free TV here in the UK. or that you had to have a satellite or cable to watch WWF. And to me, like growing up on British wrestling as I did, that was just a colorful circus. Like WCW had people who could actually do wrestling moves as opposed to just punched and posed, which was what I saw WWF as a kid. And one of the things I really liked about it was Vader. Like he was this, like, you know, Sting was flashy and colorful, and you know, Rick Rude was a cocky badass, and Brian Pillman could do all the flying. Vader just clobbered people into the mat, and as a 13-year-old I found that very, very appealing. And then I found out about his past in Japan, and then like the next year he went, oh, by the way, I can also do a moonsault. And like for like 1993, he was probably my favorite wrestler in the world.
I mean, those pretty prime years. This is like, yeah. Refresh my memory. Is that when he's WCW champion?
Yes. Yeah.
And he's doing the series with Sting and yep. feuding with like Mick Foley. And
yeah, they do the Ron Simmons cycle change.
That's right.
Yeah. And like he would even as world champion, he would still have a squash on Worldwide every, because that was the show we got every 2 or 3 weeks, he would appear and flatten sometimes one jobber, sometimes up to three. And like the Vader squash was a highlight the same way like the Sid squash was for people, you know, 2 or 3 years before.
A lot of people got beat up on WCW television. Like if you take into account Vader squashes, Sid squashes, and the Steiner Brothers squashes, a lot of people got legit beat up in that company.
Oh, yeah.
It's glorious. I love it. but yeah, so like, you know, like we talk about his time in the WBF, like I'm thinking when he's going to come at all, God, he's going to feud with everyone. He's going to do what with Shawn Michaels, what he did with Sting. No, that didn't happen.
No,
I think because he got lost politically in that company. He didn't have any, I'd say that probably Jim Ross, who wasn't enough. He didn't have enough, like, you know, enough political acumen to navigate the WWF of the mid 90s.
Also, I think came from a harder style into a place that was a lot softer. So like the WWF of 1996, nobody's making contact on punches. Nobody's like really chucking each other around. The rings of like pre-1999 WWF rings were rock solid. And it was only once Vince started taking bumps in them, he was like, we have to make these into trampolines. So like they weren't used to getting like roughed up by somebody like Vader. Whereas, you know, the WCW was only just no longer the NWA spit and sawdust, wasn't it? Like in 92, 93.
Yeah.
It was like a different type of show.
I mean, like what is it, like some things that have, like, I mean, I think he tried to have a pretty decent series with The Undertaker. I think, you know, this stuff, anything he tried to do with like Mick Foley, they tried to recreate their magic in WCW, but it wasn't happening. Then he got, what was it? Where did he get arrested? For attacking the TV show host.
Oh, Kuwait.
He got arrested in Kuwait.
The Kuwait tour in 96, yeah.
And this is when the WWF is obsessed with making bigger men go on diets and lose weight because of Yokozuna, you know, like his health problems in the company. And they were like, so he has to deal with that as well politically backstage. Is like, and there's that famous time he's like loses a match and he goes, I'm a fat bastard, takes off his mask, I think. And it's just like really shocking. It's just pre-Attitude Era. So you're not really used to hearing people like say, like, you know, shit or anything like that, or, you know, like ass or anything like that, let alone shit. So in up until 1998, he's in the WWF. There is like a time he does like a special appearance for All Japan Pro Wrestling on their 25th anniversary show at the Tokyo Dome. That's headlined by the very famous Misawa Kawada match, where Kawada beats Misawa and wins the title from him. He's teaming with his longtime rival Dan Hansen, the men in the his, you know, spans like years. Basically knocks out in another and so like a big, like he was in, and they took on a team of Johnny Ace and Kenta Kobashi, who are the you know, global epic tough team. And this is the May 1st, 1998 show of All Japan, but he's still contracted to the WWF at this time. This is kind of a favor, I guess, that Vince allowed him. I also think Vince didn't really care if you did this one-off show.
He was kind of loaned out a bit, because like 97, he and Shamrock did a match in FMW. There was like, it was at a point, look, don't forget 1998, Vince is still not winning Monday night in the US. So he's way more open to working with other people. So you get stuff like the ECW invasion, you get his talent being loaned out to Japan and that kind of thing. Like he was still in the 2 years of getting stomped by Nitro every Monday night.
Right.
And like, so he's not in the WWE hustle, is he, at that point?
No, he's, I mean, he's putting over tons of people. He's like he's just a job guy, a glorified job guy. I mean, his last television match is on September 29th, 1998. He loses to Mark Mero, of all people, in less than 5 minutes. And that's his on Monday Night Raw. And that's his last appearance for WWF. And then it's not until, later in 98 that he debuts. They announced that he's going to join All Japan Pro Wrestling. And I to much fanfare, because it's like not only is it the return of Vader to Japan as touring the country again, but he's doing it now for All Japan Pro Wrestling, because before, of course, he was a New Japan star. He was also in the UWFI, but he had never really done anything for Giant Baba. And this is the first time he's going to do, well, not like first full-time thing he's going to do with guys who were like, people I'm sure were like salivating at dream matches. Oh, Misawa versus Vader, Kawada versus Vader, Kobashi versus Vader, Itawa versus Vader, and the such. So this is it. He's going to join All Japan. This is about a month after the WWF, leaving the WWF, and he enters the Real World Tag League with a lot of fanfare, a lot of hype, because he's going to be teaming again with Stan Hansen. And this is a great tournament for Vader, because he would have him and Hansen would defeat the team of Kawada and Taue, Takayama, Nomori, No Fear, Misawa, and Ogawa. And in the tournament brackets, they would defeat Akiyama and Kobashi, and they would go all the way to the finals, where they would again meet up with Kobashi and Akiyama, who were like pretty much the push team in All Japan of 99. And so, but they would lose the finals of the Real World Tag League to Kenta Kobashi and Jun Akiyama. But let's go into 1999. Kawada has the match with Misawa. He breaks his arm during that match, wrestles for another 17 minutes with a broken arm, dumps Misawa on his head, creating the famous Ganzo bomb, power bomb, pile driver move. But he has to relinquish the title the day later because he's broken his arm and he can't compete. So they have a match to determine who's going to win the vacated title. It's between Vader and Akira Taue. And then Vader wins the Triple Crown title. So he has completed like an amazing, he's one of the few people at that time to have been both the IWGP World Heavyweight Champion and the All Japan Triple Crown Champion. I think he's the first foreigner to have done it. I should have looked this up, but I don't think there's any other foreigner who has been both the IWGP Champion and the All Japan Triple Crown Champion.
If you see me looking off camera, I'm rapidly scrolling through his Wikipedia to find out if it says on there.
Yes. So like of the various foreigners who have won the IWGP title, I do not think any of them have ever been the Triple Crown Champion, unless there's some missing Brock Lesnar title reign that I missing out on. Him and Kobashi, who we're going to be talking about, have their first ever singles match on January 15th, 1999, which Vader would win.
Which I rewatched again today, actually. So I did a show with Alan Forel last year about Vader, and we basically covered his whole career. Like, we even found some of his stuff in Mexico to watch. And we watched Vader versus Kobashi for that. I rewatched that today, and I didn't realize that it had already been set up, but they put some spice on it in the New Year Battle Royal on the 2nd of January, where I don't think those two even get in the ring. Like, they just brawl on the floor, and Vader busts Kobashi's eyebrow open. There's blood all over the place. You can hear people getting eliminated in the ring, but the cameras are just focused on those two, like, being pulled apart and battering each other. It's also Vader's first ever singles match in All Japan. So not just the first match between Kobashi and Vader, it's Vader's first singles match in the company as well.
I mean, it's very clear that like that's who they wanted Vader to be programmed with as his biggest rival in the company. Not necessarily Misawa or Kawada. It was going to be Ken Kobashi, because I think stylistically and like even size-wise, I think they match up perfectly.
Yeah, I think it's the right. It's the closest you can get to recreating the Vader Sting dynamic, I think, even though like Kobashi is considerably larger than Sting, I think.
I also think he's like the best baby face in the country.
Yeah. You know? So I thought it was weird when you asked if I wanted to come on this show, because I'm not known as being like a super fan of All Japan Pro Wrestling. Like there's bits I definitely like, but as a general style, I kind of struggle with it. But what I am a fan of is Vader, as I've mentioned, and I'm interested in anything he does anywhere. And if I have to pick a pillar, I've always gravitated towards Kobashi, because like for me, he's the one who looks most like a star. He's the most charismatic. He's got the fire. He's got the moves. He's got the most expressive face. He feels as an outsider looking in the most complete of them, if that makes any sense.
Yes, I understand. Yeah.
So like, I don't see any fire in Misawa. I like Kawada, but his style is so different to the others. And I will admit, like, Taue is a big blank spot for me. I've only really ever seen him in like undercard six man's choke slamming people, and that was about it. And like, I'm aware he has many fans. He doesn't exactly have the superstar look, does he?
So, no, but that's part of his appeal for,
yeah, I
for
guess.
People like me, I think.
And I am discovering that now as I get older. But Kobashi, like when I think we talked about it when you came on our show, like you got a tape that was half New Japan, half All Japan. You gravitated towards the All Japan side, whereas I had a tape that was half New Japan, half All Japan, and I gravitated towards the New Japan side. But on the All Japan stuff, like I was always interested in Kobashi.
I mean, he is the most accessible, I feel, yeah, all the pillars to Western yeah. wrestling fans. Yeah.
Yeah.
Their second encounter, Kobashi and Vader, would occur during the round robin tournament portion of the Champion Carnival on April 8th. And that match would go to a time limit draw because, you know, which makes sense because about a week later on April 16th, the match we're going to talk about today, they would meet in the finals of the Champion Carnival. So let's go to our review. I'm going to give a bit of a background of the show that this match takes place on. It emanates from the Nippon Budokan with a listed attendance of 16,300 fans. And, you know, just for context, here's the rest of the card. In a singles match, Takeshi Morishima defeats Makoto Hashi in 10 minutes and 21 seconds. Yoshinobu Kanemaru defeats Naomichi Marufuji in 11 minutes and 13 seconds. In a six-man comedy match, Haruka Aigen, Masanobu Fuchi, and Tsuyoshi Kikuchi defeat Mitsuo Momota, Rusher Kimura, and Satoru Asako in 13 minutes, 37 seconds. I usually think that's anytime any of these old guy comedy matches go more than like 5 minutes, it's a bit too long.
Oh, yeah.
yeah. So I can't imagine having to endure. But, you know, this is like, I'm going to go to the merch stand and go to the concession stand and get
It's extending the interval, isn't it, really?
Yes. Tag team match, Jun Izumida and Tamen Honda, who we've talked about before on this show, against Jinsei Suzaki and Hayabusa. In this match, they defeat the Headhunters, Headhunter A and Headhunter B, in 6 minutes and 42 seconds.
Not even a weirder match than them fighting Shinzaki and Hayabusa? Like, I perversely kind of want to see that.
I mean, I've never been a big Headhunters fan. I can see why, like, they would be booked by All Japan because they're so big and, like,
they're a freak show.
I think, you know, like, ever since the 80s, I think, you know, Road Warriors, somehow, like, big people coming up, especially in Japan, to fight their neighbors. Like, oh, look, our guys are so defeating more times or something. Team Albright and Manuakea Mossman defeat Jun Akiyama and Kentaro Shig in 12 minutes and 50 seconds. Do you have a thought there?
It's Kentaro Shiga. I once got trapped in a very large traffic jam with him in the back of the car for 7 hours trying to make our way to a show in the UK. I used to work in British wrestling a long time ago, and Shiga and Kishin Kawabata were in the back of the car as we were driving up, and it was just nonstop traffic. And Shiga has his very distinct, very gruff voice in the style of I can picture him, but I can't think of his name, the fella from New Japan with the big tan.
Hanma.
Yes, yeah. So he sounds quite like Hanma. That's it. Thank you. But he was very excited to be in a car with two English people. So he got to practice his English. Kishin Kawabata speaks no English, but can, we discovered, entertain himself by phonetically singing along to Elvis songs on the radio.
There you go. Is this when Shiga has his like his perm? This is the point.
Yeah,
he has his leg perm.
He was much more. He was much more in the. It was when he was doing like comedy stuff for Noah rather than anything else. Right. So much later on in his career. I absolutely no idea how he got booked on the tour of the UK.
Obviously, as a favor to Misawa.
Maybe.
Okay, I'm going to come over, but you got to book like these guys on one of your shows, like over there as well.
Yeah,
tag team match, Takao Morney and Yoshihiro Takayama defeat Johnny Ace and Johnny Smith in 13 minutes, 11 seconds. A six-man tag team match, Masahiro Kakihara, Mitsuhara Misawa, and Yoshinari Ogawa defeat Akira Taue, Jinsei Shinzaki, and Masao Inoue. Well, what an oddball grouping of talent there in 20 minutes and 59 seconds. And
it's
this, of
like
course,
the six guys who were left over, really, isn't it?
It is. This is like a lot of Japanese booking, or kind of like modern day AEW booking is. I feel kind of similar. Who should we put in this, you know, ladder match? Oh, who's not on the card? Rest of the card. Let's just put these guys on the show. Anyways, which brings us to our main event, which is the Champion Carnival finals between Vader and Kenta Kobashi. And as the match starts, the crowd is firmly behind Kobashi. And I want to make a note that joining the regular commentator, whose name always escapes me, is one Toshiaki Kawada. And I have to say, the dulcet tones of Toshiaki Kawada, adding a lot of insight into various aspects of this match, especially about, how Vader is viewed by his by opponents. And like he makes comments about like, oh, this is how Kobashi trains for the Champion Carnival. He's a nut. You know, he's insane when he trains.
So my Japanese is very basic. I'm trying to learn. I did notice that if this was someone different on commentary as to the January match, who was Misawa, who was incredibly dry. The commentator would be freaking out, going like, oh, Kobashi's hitting with a brain buster. It's a brain buster. Mr. Misawa, what do you think? And he would go, I saw Destiny. And that would be it. That was all you get out of him. Whereas like, Kawada was very, he actually sounded like a commentator on this.
He's really good, I feel.
Yeah.
Listen, if Misawa was watching some dirty movie, I guarantee you, based on his reputation, he would have been way more excited and animated versus watching a wrestling match. His nickname was the erotic president of Pro Wrestling Noah.
Well,
from his appearances on talk shows and stuff like that in Japan. Maybe a lot of people didn't know that. Maybe a lot of people didn't want to know that. Well, sorry, let the cat out of the bag, so to speak. All right, so let's get into the match, Kieran. Vader gets behind and immediately goes for German suplexes on Kobashi. Kobashi switches positions and tries for his own, but Vader backs him into a corner where he starts clubbering him. I'm sure this is part where you're really happy, because this is, this is a Vader signature, just laying in with punches and like kind of like the, the back
inside of the forearm. Yeah. I only found out when I did the show with Alan that that's called the Vader Hammer, because it's never called that in the US. And I'm like, that's a very cool name for something.
He's one of the few people who like uses the inside of his forearm try to knock people around. And he does this to Kobashi in the corner, and he tries to go for another German, but Kobashi is, it's just, the thing is, it's like, it's not even 5 minutes into the match. It's Kobashi is too fresh to get German suplex, even by Vader this early in the match. But Vader tries again, but again, Kobashi grabs the ropes. Vader then, I thought this was great. Vader then switches his strategy and he rolls him up in a schoolboy.
Yeah. Like, you never see Vader do that. He just drops down behind as though he's a cruiserweight and tries to roll him up. And I don't think I've ever seen Vader try a schoolboy roll up before.
Like, he's
he's heel, and he's just going like, okay, I'll just try and pin him.
I would be perversely amused if that won the match in like under 10 minutes. The Champions Carnival final in Budokan Hall between these two legends.
Do they have cushions in Budokan that you can set on fire and throw at the ring?
No, because that's what would happen. Well, I'm pretty sure people would be like demanding a refund.
Oh yeah,
if they only got like less than 10 minutes of a Champion Carnival final with a roll up. But again, I say perversely amused of that. What would happen?
I have been to a Noah show at Corican Hall where the main event was a tag team match that barely got in the ring. It was just a brawl all around the building, and the ref threw it out after 6 minutes. And I swear to God, I thought there was going to be a riot. They had to send Takashi Sugiura out on the microphone to calm everybody down. It's the only time I felt like that at a Japanese wrestling show. It was so weird.
Yeah, you can't do that. You can do that like in the middle of the card.
I don't know. They had a big tag match like immediately before it with the big stars in, and this was like it was Big Murakami and I can't remember who else. Like, I like, he's a wild guy anyway.
Okay,
I can't remember who the other participants were, but he's the only one I remember. But yeah, they had a big tag match with the names like immediately before it. Why didn't they just swap them over or do the double DQ before the interval? It was weird.
Sometimes bookers get, you know,
funny idea.
They think they're smarter than they actually are.
Yeah.
Anyways, Vader then decides to wear Kobashi down by wrestling him on the mat and making him carry his considerable weight. Basically, he gets his back, and Vader's just trying to, you know, just apply his own body weight to Kobashi's back. And as strong as Kobashi is like, Vader is what, 300, maybe 290? Yeah.
So the Vader was always billed at 450 in the US, but like the inside line was he was usually about 100 pounds lighter than that. So he was usually like in the 340 to 350 range. And also, let's not forget here, he's 44 years old.
That's right. Vader tries for a Fujiwara armbar, but Kobashi rolls through. So Vader just transitions into this really nice looking cross chest arm breaker. So like Vader kind of like showing off like, hey, you know, I learned some stuff when I was in the UWFI. I learned some stuff in New Japan Pro Wrestling guys like Hashimoto and Keiji Muto. So he's applying it here.
The interesting thing about that move is it's something I noted when I was watching all those matches with Alan, was like throughout his career, that has always been his kryptonite. Like that's the submission move he goes down to is the cross armbar. Even before it was like Takada's big thing and like the killer move of the UWFI, if he had to submit in New Japan, it was very often to the cross armbar.
Well, there you go. I mean,
career weakness against it.
The way you overcome a weakness is by mastering it.
So absolutely.
That was his strategy here. Kobashi is too close to the ropes, so when Vader hyper extends his arm, he's able to get his foot on the ropes. Vader gets Kobashi on the ropes again and goes for a swing, but Kobashi ducks and blocks and starts peppering Vader with slaps. Vader retaliates with his trademark blows, but then they start a nice strike exchange that Vader wins with a headbutt. He shoots Kobashi to the ropes and runs him over with his entire body. Is there a name for this? I forget.
Yeah, Vader.
The what? The Vader attack?
A Vader attack, where he just basically like jumps in the air, spreads all his arms and legs, and then like bashes into somebody. Yeah, they just call it Vader attack. The Fez Press?
Yeah, the Fez Press. Not the Jack. Yes,
yeah.
The Fez Press. This is kind of like that, except Vader doesn't go down. He just, you know, just kind of, he doesn't do a press. He just like,
yeah, you know, he does the Fez, but not a big, press.
You know, redwood tree. Yeah. That's right. A big redwood tree. That's what he is. Vader hits his signature short-range clothesline, but Kobashi absorbs them. Actually, he hits a couple of them. Kobashi absorbs them. And this is really now, the fans are really getting behind this. They're like, oh, shit, he didn't even go down. He's just like taking it all in. So, but Vader finally knocks him down with a regular lariat and starts punching him while Kobashi is on his back. Vader dominates Kobashi in the corner with a series of strikes and blows. So this is basically the Vader control segment. And that, I always think one of my favorite things of a Vader match is his control segments, because he is just, when he gets the upper hand, he's just brutal with people. And it's great to watch.
Long ago compared Vader to, if you had shaved a bear and shown it pro wrestling, like, this is what you would get. And like, when he's mauling somebody like this, like the Vader hammers and the headbutts and just smothering someone, like, that's exactly what it looks like to me.
You don't really have to shave the bear that much. You just have to make it dangerous, really,
Like down the middle of the head, I guess. Around this time, like, Kobashi's getting battered by Vader in the corner, and the camera focuses on a bandage on Kobashi's leg, but that doesn't really come into anything. Like, does he have a kind of serious injury coming into this?
Yeah, it's called doing the moonsault for all his career.
Oh yeah, fine. I believe we call it Muto knee. Yeah, okay.
No, like, the thing with Kobashi is, like, he's always had some kind of bandage or, like, you know, leg brace on his knees. Sure. Always. Like, pretty much from the mid-90s, like, say, I can't exactly recall when, but by the time he's teaming with Misawa, he's got his knee pads, of course, but he's also got, like, padding underneath his knee pads.
Yeah.
So, and then there's a point where it's just, like, this giant, looks like a tensor band, like the tan tensor band on his knee. And then there's the point where he's, like, got two black ones, or one black one on one particular knee. But it's the thing with, like, if you do a moonsault, you're crashing on your knees a lot. And it's like, you know, when you're like 260 pounds, like, you know, kind of Kobashi legit is, like, it's not a good idea to do that many. You're right, Kieran.
Yeah, like I said,
it doesn't play any role.
No
go ahead.
Like I watched this and the January match back to back, and like, these two guys have a legitimate combined weight of 600 pounds, and you get 5 moonsaults between them across those two matches, which is crazy.
It is crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Vader whips Kobashi into the opposing corner and hits a running splash, but Kobashi immediately comes out with a running lariat for a nice 2 count on Vader. And then Kobashi's basically turned the tide. He drags Vader to the outside and immediately starts punching him, which is a rare thing to see Kobashi do. It was using, like, close fist punches in matches. And as much as I love Kobashi, I have to say, Kieran, I'm not a fan of his punches. I don't think he's mastered the art of throwing them.
Much more of a chopper than a puncher, isn't he? So firstly, I really love that spot of him getting whipped into the corner. He gets crushed with the splash and he just screams and steams out with this lariat that knocks Vader down. And it's only Vader getting his foot on the ropes that saves him. They then go to the floor, and that's kind of a callback to January, where Vader was in control. He drags Kobashi outside, bangs him on the head with a chair and power bombs him on the floor. And like this time, as you say, Kobashi instead has got him against the railing and is beating him on the railing, and then pulls up the pads and DDTs him on the concrete. So it's kind of like turnabout fair play for January. I didn't realize that there was the 30-minute draw in between those two matches, so I don't know if there's any of that that plays into this as well. Into this match as well.
Well, I mean, before he does the DDT on the concrete, because he removes the blue mats, he goes from punching to just then viciously stomping on Vader. He's just like, it's rare that you see Kobashi this vicious. Like, usually in a lot of the matches he has with the other pillars, he's usually the underdog. He's fighting from underneath, but he doesn't really show kind of like that often. I'm not going to say never, but not that often that he goes to like just stomping somebody, especially on the outside. So it's really kind of like, I think an indicator of like where they want this rivalry to go, that they want it to be a long-term thing going for, you know, like for when Kobashi is obviously slated to be the guy who's going to take over from Misawa. Because even in 99, like Misawa's like just feeling it. And he's like, well, I don't want to necessarily be carrying this company anymore. I'll always be a star, but I don't want to be carrying the company. And he's going to be the book, and he's going to take over for when Baba dies for a short period. And he's like, Kobashi's my guy. I want Kobashi to be my guy.
If the split hadn't happened the next summer, he probably would have been.
Oh, yeah. Like,
once they start Noah, he needs building up to be that again in a new company, or it's perhaps seen that way.
The ironic thing is like, because of the bad blood between Misawa and Kawada, like Kawada doesn't go to Noah but Kawada is the guy with the least amount of injuries, like in terms of like that takes him out for a long period of time. Because like if you look at Kobashi and Kawada in the early 2000s, it's like Kobashi's injured pretty much 80% of the time.
Like quadruple wrestle. Joint surgery and the cancer and the comeback from cancer. And then doesn't he come back and then immediately re-injure an elbow he's just had operated on? Yeah. And
that kind of, something like that. But Kawada has a pretty lengthy run or like series of runs where he's doesn't get injured that often, or he can still compete. So it's kind of ironic because like I always think it's one of those what ifs, those sliding doors. It's like Kawada goes with them and Masao pushes him on the same level as Kobashi. And I think Noah has, there's a lot of things that wouldn't have happened in Pro Wrestling Noah, but anyway, we're diverging from our main point. Kobashi throws Vader back into the ring and hits a leg drop across the back of his head. In a very impressive feat of strength, Kobashi gets the big man over for a vertical suplex. He didn't do a delay or anything like that, but still, hey, he got Vader over his head for a suplex. He goes to for a mount and tries a ground and pound. He then goes for a side suplex, hits it, but only gets a two off of Vader. Again, still too early. I don't think we're yet at the crescendo of this match here.
Not remotely, but like that's not the point here. The point is something I noticed and really liked about this match. Every time Kobashi has Vader on his back, he tries to pin him. So Vader's strategy throughout the match is crush him. Like all you'll notice like a lot of what he's doing is focused on Kobashi's torso, and he's crushing the chest every possible point he can to stop him breathing, hold him down and pin him. Kobashi, on the other hand, is he takes every opportunity when the bigger man is flat backed on the mat to go for a cover. Like just end this hell, win and go home.
Yes. And get the champion carnival. Cause like if he wins the champion carnival, then he's next in line for a title shot. It's Kobashi's turn to take control, and he goes for chops, including a spinning back chop to the face of Vader. He then tries for a sleeper, but Vader's head and neck are so much bigger than Kobashi's arms for it to be effective. But Vader turns the tide.
Kobashi's kind of got Cena arms as well. Like you can't wrap them around anything.
I think even I'm pretty sure Cena would not have a good time trying to get around Umaga's neck and head because they're so much bigger. Kobashi's in control, but Vader turns the tide with an eye poke, some punches, and a short range layer. So now you see kind of like Vader's like, okay, I'm going to hit to do a little bit of underhanded stuff, like an eye poke, which
it reminds you he's a heel, but it's also targeting the eye that he busted open at the Battle Royal and was a factor in a factor isn't right. He was going after it in the January match as well. So in the January match, Kobashi has got, it's been stitched. He's got a plaster over it and he's got a bandage around it. Just so you know, he definitely has an injury under there. And Vader, I think they were hoping they could pop it open again. Like Vader would just like dig a knuckle into it or, you know, go for the eye or go for the brow. And he starts doing that again here.
Yeah, I mean, like talking about all these bandages on Kobashi's head and stuff, it's like pro wrestling, not known for its subtlety when trying to talk about injuries there. He jumps down Kobashi's chest. Wasn't fun take. He hits two splashes and only gets a two count here. There's a slam, mounts the second rope for a diving splash, but only gets a two as Kobashi kicks out to the applause of the crowd. And this is where a big Kobashi call breaks out among the fans in Budokan Hall. Vader misses another corner splash and Kobashi nails him in the left knee with a series of drop kicks to that particular body part. There's a dragon screw leg whip and then turns it into an ankle lock and then a heel hook with a grapevine. So, Kobashi also been watching maybe some UWF, maybe some rings at this point. There's another drop kick to the left leg and then Kobashi turns Vader over in a single leg Boston Crab, I love this part of the match because it elicits this amazing cry of pain from Vader that, yeah. You know, like, which you don't really hear too often in the career of Big Van Vader. He doesn't really elicit too many cries of pain.
No, but so one of the things I think the key to Vader is and always has been his selling. Like, he is called a monster, but he's not a monster. He's just a very large, skillful human being who's hard to keep down. And what he does is he sells you enough to make you think this is the time your hero is going to finally scale the mountain and beat him. He's not a no-selling stiff by any stretch of the imagination, and never has been. He sells a lot in his matches.
Yes. But I just think, you know, like, this cry was just so realistic to me that I'm thinking, oh, he must have torqued something accidentally, like Kobashi on Vader, that elicited like a legit cry of pain from him. But regardless, Vader is too close to the ropes. He escapes the move by grabbing them. There's another strike exchange, and then Vader tosses Kobashi out of the ring with a backdrop. He falls up with a diving splash from the apron to the floor. So also another big, you know, great point about Vader is he is, for a man his size, he's incredibly agile, and he's not afraid to do like high risk moves, like where he's leaving his feet.
No, absolutely not. He is an all rounder. Like, you know, the people think of him as being like the big brawler, but like, he shows in this match he can do that part. He can wrestle, as we saw earlier on. Like, he can do the submission style, as we saw earlier on, and as we will get to towards the end of the match, can do the flying as well. 44 years old and 350 pounds or whatever he is at the time.
Vader dominates Kobashi and then goes for another flying splash, from the second rope, but Kobashi catches him in midair with a power slam. Very impressive.
Vader loves that spot. He does it in loads of his big matches. I've seen him do it with Sting, Shawn Michaels, Kobashi, like all over the place. There are sometimes where he does it the other way around, where he's the one doing the power slam. But like, it's one of his favorite signature bumps to chuck in.
Kobashi stops Vader from hitting a moonsault and tosses him down with a power bomb and gets him over with a German suplex. Kobashi then lands his moonsault, but Vader kicks out. Kobashi misses two running lariats, but Vader kicks him over with a German. Vader lands his moonsault, but Kobashi kicks out of two, and this crowd is on fire because you think, okay, Vader's winning the match with this moonsault, but nope, Kobashi is not going to die at this point in the match. Vader then hits his signature power bomb, and Kobashi kicks out of that. This crowd's going nuts because they're like, he's just not being killed by Vader with his signature moves here. Vader hits another running splash and lands on Kobashi for the 1, 2, and 3, and he wins the Champion Carnival in 19 minutes and 11 seconds. So it's interesting. Like, so all these moves that would normally win a lot of his matches previously, the moonsault and the power palm, these were to wear down Kobashi enough where basically like the Vader attack, like what you dubbed the Vader attack, is what actually wins the match for him.
But it's not just wearing down. He does try to pin after each one. And you see after the powerbomb, Vader gets up and he's like to the ref and to the crowd, what do I have to do to keep him down? And he's just like, screw it, and runs at him and happens to fall on top of him and basically just smothers Kobashi's head and chest to get the win. I really like the last 5 minutes of this match. All the big near falls, the crowd are going crazy. Basically everything from that leap into the power slam onwards. I laughed very much. I know it's the get ready, something's coming signal from Kobashi, but he chops Vader on the butt cheek as Vader is on the top rope to get him ready for the power bomb, and that just made me laugh. Like the crowd going crazy, them hitting each other with the big stuff, Kobashi refusing to die, and Vader having to resort to just crushing him and smothering him to get the win. Great stuff. I think overall I prefer the January match, but like this is still great to me.
I mean, so this cage match, users give this an average of a 7 out of 10. Dave Meltzer from the Wrestling Observer gave it 4 stars. I'll give it a solid 4 stars myself.
Yeah, that's what I thought as well. Like Dave, I think Dave gave the January one 4.25.
I it's a solid match.
Yeah, absolutely.
It, that, that hints at becoming an epic at times, but ends before it can get into that kind of All Japan 5-star range. Still, don't get me wrong. I don't think every match, especially including like, you know, something like the Champions Carnival Final, has to hit a 30-minute mark to be good. I think for variety, you should have matches that end a bit sooner than what people expect. I think G1 Climax Final should adopt the same kind of philosophy, to be honest with you.
You should end sooner than you expect, and they should end with a move you don't expect. Like, I love wrestling. I've loved wrestling my whole life. I see a lot of patterned wrestling. I call it finisher pro res, like where you know that it's not going to end until someone hits their finish. And growing up on World of Sport, where it was 2 out of 3 falls and rounds, and nobody had a finish apart from Mark Rocco, perhaps, who did a tombstone. And then WCW, where the main event of Worldwide each week would usually end with an inside cradle rather than somebody's finisher. Like, I like that in wrestling. As much as I love the Vader powerbomb, and, you know, that should be his killer move, I love that he had to resort to just basically a bully tactic of using his body weight to get the win. It was unexpected. Like, I expected him to win. I didn't expect him to win like that when I first saw this match.
So with that, the aftermath of Vader winning the Champion Carnival is he would defend the Triple Crown against Mitsuharu Misawa and drop the title to him on May 2nd. Vader would regain the Triple Crown on May 30th, defeating Misawa at Budokan Hall. So it's kind of a weird hot potatoing of the title.
I didn't really look at the dates, but I did kind of have a quick look at Vader's singles record. And he pins all 4 pillars in singles matches in the space of a year, wins the vacant Triple Crown, wins Champion Carnival, wins the Triple Crown again over Misawa, and the only people who beat him in singles matches are Misawa and Kobashi. Like, he was very well looked after by All Japan Pro Wrestling. Oh,
yeah, so, like, you could tell, like, you know, he's part of a strategy that pretty much Misawa is at this point booking the company in 99, that he is like, okay, he's going to be our top foreign star.
Yeah.
And because, like, we're, you know, Hansen's too old now. Steve Williams is too beat up. He can't do it. Johnny Ace is never going to be bad. Gary Albright is a good mid-card guy. I think they were never going to really push Gary Albright as a top foreign guy. But you have Vader, who is already a star in New Japan, who is a star in WCW.
Yep.
He's a
powerful force to overcome. He's a multi-time world champion in at least 4 different promotions before he even gets to All Japan.
Yeah.
I've mentioned his age now 3 times, 44 years old, but he's still got it. He can still turn it on in the big matches.
Yeah. So this is the thing with this is much cash. Japan bad years in WWF. It's like this how strong is, like, listen, forget all the stuff he did 2 years ago in America. He's here. He's and it's because he experiences a renaissance in his career. People are talking about him in a positive manner again, as opposed to like the last, you know, year and a half of the front. And like his key title reign last for 2 2000 Budokan Hall, and then pretty much wraps up, you know, like the significant part of his All Japan career, because then he would actually join the Exodus to go to Pro Wrestling Noah with, you know, Masao Kobashi and 90% of the All Japan roster. So him and Too Cold Scorpio are gonna team up there, and it was interesting. I always thought it was interesting how the legit friendship between, you know, Leon White and Vader and Too Cold Scorpio. Like, and I thought that's a pretty interesting like grouping to have them be tag team partners on undercard matches.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I've got all the time in the world for Too Cold Scorpio as well. He also came along while I was watching WCW, Ron Simmons' mystery partner, whatever clash it was at the end of 92. And a kid who didn't watch wrestling came up to me in the playground the next day and was like, did you see that Too Cool Scorpion guy on TV? because he had done his flips and he made an impression on this kid who just happened to be watching wrestling. Yeah, I love Scorpio. But yeah, like Scorpio and Vader, it's this kind of oddball tag team is real interesting.
Yeah, I think like if the split doesn't happen, I think what would have happened was Vader would have formed his own unit. And I think it would have been him and Scorpio, maybe Gary Albright as part of that, maybe like Jim Steele or George Hines. I don't know, one of those guys would be like the pin eater. No. Well, it would have been one of they would need a pin eater, so it would have been one of those guys or something, someone along that level. But this
Albright's dead in January of 2000, isn't he?
He dies pretty early, yeah. But there's a short period, I think, where they do team up a couple of times on a tour.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen Vader. A tag match of those two against Kobashi and Akiyama.
I mean, that's a great pairing because like Albright's loves throwing people around with suplexes. Yeah. He has like the shoot background.
Yeah.
And like, I think if he didn't die, like, and him Vader team up, I think they would have had, kind of another version of like the Williams and Gordy tag team in Vader and him. Champion
Carnival 2000. Tag League 2000, perhaps.
Yeah. So Gary Albright is a shame, like him dying at that time and at such a young age as well. But Kieran, this brings us to the end of this review. Thank you very much. It's been a long time since I've seen this match, so it was really nice revisiting it. And I appreciate like a lot of the context you brought with like, I didn't watch the other matches you watched the January match recently.
I had to come prepared. If I hadn't done my homework, I was worried about getting eaten alive.
No, not at all. But again, yeah, like, so people can find you at Must See Matches. Where can people find you on social media?
Yeah, so we are at Must See Matches on Twitter, Instagram, and Mastodon. If you want to subscribe to the show, you should go to linktr.ee/mustseematches, and that's all the way subscribed. It's got links to Mark's writings and posts. It's got a link to the entire list of, I think it's 1,066 unique matches that were nominated for the project. As I said, we're on the show, we're covering the top 104. Recent episodes include JP Houlihan from Grapple Spotlight talking Bret Hart versus Steve Austin from Survivor Series 96, wrestler and commentator Sean Orleans talking AJ Styles versus Shinsuke Nakamura from Wrestle Kingdom 10, and Jamie O'D from Dramatic DDT talking the Akito versus Asuka, not that one, Ippon Light Tube Death Match from DDT, which is one of my favorite matches. I love that match. I am at Kieran Edits on Twitter, that's where we can be found.
Yeah, and of course, you can find me. Most of my stuff is at postwrestling.com. I'm also doing Star Wars reviews with JP Houlihan or Greg Grapple. Check that out. I think these are usually on the free feed, so you don't have to be a patron to listen to those. I got Post Perez coming up. We're going to have the return of MCU later. I think with Secret Invasion sooner rather than later, though they have not announced an air date for those. I'm doing stuff away with John.
Marvel comic. When I was seven, I still have it. It's the UK imprint, but I still have it today. It's dated like sometime in 86. I have that. Yeah, Secret Wars. It's got Ultron grabbing Human Torch's leg on the front cover.
I think there's like, that's like a milestone Marvel comic. With Secret Wars coming up in the MCU, I think it's going to be more based on the mid 2000s. 2016 series rather than the 1980 series, but we'll be talking about that in the coming years on MCU later as well. But at WH Park 9 you can find me, and we're gonna come back next month with someone. I haven't just booked the guest yet, but we'll have someone coming on next month to talk about something from All Japan in the 90s, or maybe Pro Wrestling NOAH, or All Japan in the 80s. Sometimes we delve outside the sandbox every once in a while. But Kieran, thank you so much for joining us. To all the people who have been supporting the show through I should actually, before we go, I have to thank James Edwards and Sarah Mock with the silent H at the end. Thank you for buying the Long and Winding Railroad t-shirts. I really appreciate your support on that, and until next time, to everyone, Goodbye.